Hello, this is Chuck Shelton of Albemarle Cider Works in North Garden, Virginia, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Going up, going up.
Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wintcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. Bringing us into this here episode 253 on this new year of 2021 is one of our featured guests on this week's podcast. That'd be Chuck Shelton of Albemarle Cider Works and Vintage Virginia Apples. Joining Chuck this week will be cider maker David Timmerman, who also works at Albemarle, and they'll both be talking about blending cider, which might seem like a science, but really it requires an amazing palate and a whole bunch of understanding about apples. We'll get to that feature chat in a moment, but first, a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. If you're listening to this here podcast, then I have a pretty good hunch that you are into cider news. You want to stay in the sphere that's relevant, getting good ideas, and just be connected. I mean, that's so important in so many ways. So I'd like to recommend two online cider blogs that are always kicking out the good news, always keeping us informed, providing relatable recipes, just info on new releases, and they're hitting on things that I don't necessarily talk about on the podcast. So the first one is Cider Scene, and you can look that up, ciderscene.com. Sign up for their newsletter. And the second one is Cider Culture. So it's ciderculture.com. I'm going to have a link in the show notes in this here episode 253 to both. When you log onto their site, up will pop a box and say, you want to subscribe? And do it. I mean, what do you have to lose? You could always like delete the email if you don't have time, but I'm here to tell you right now, it is worth your time. You got nothing to lose and everything to gain, and that is what 2021 is all about. And talking about that same note of subscribing and signing up, have you received your invitation yet from the American Cider Association? Because they are inviting you to the 11th year of their annual Global Cider Conference, which is called CiderCon. This year is taking place February 3rd through the 5th, and they're taking advantage of the opportunity to debut a virtual event that's going to be adapting many of the beloved CiderCon traditions to a virtual landscape. It's going to be 3 full days of online programming. Highlights of CiderCon include a virtual trade show. There's going to be 30-plus educational sessions from cutting-edge beverage, business, and cider experts from all over the world. Woohoo! You know that's going to be fun. One of the special highlights includes a cider cooking demonstration from a very famous cookbook author by the name of Nancy Singleton Hatsu in Japan. And of course, my buddy Lee Reeve of Insider Japan. He's hooking her up with some local craft ciders, and she's incorporating those into her cooking, which celebrates artisan Japanese culinary traditions. I mean, I'm just mouthwatering thinking about that. There's also a cider making track that has lots of great topics, including a session on carbonation, canning, blending, and a session being moderated by me, Rhea Wintcaller, on fermenting with quince. I'm actually recording that workshop this week to prepare it for CiderCon, and I'll be telling you more about that in upcoming episodes. Tickets are just $95 for all American Cider Association members, and there is a bulk pricing available. But just because you're not a member doesn't mean you can't join. And definitely, if you're a cider enthusiast, you could also sign up too. Just visit ciderassociation.org. And one more note about all this, you should know about Cider Summit. I've talked about my buddy Alan Shapiro for a while, and he and his team at Cider Summit are putting together a special tasting kit to celebrate CiderCon, and they'll ship it directly to you. And they have a special online virtual event taking place during that week also. So, man. If you're into keeping your stress on the low side for 2021 and you are a commercial maker looking to get out in the world while we're still managing coronavirus, then act now to get your cider into the New York International Cider Competition. That's going to be taking place on February 21st, and you have till the 19th of February. But, you know, I'll talk about stress. You don't want to worry about that. Sign up now. Go to NYICiderCompetition.com. There you could register, get all the fine details, and then you could go into your little bottle room or your can room and pick out the most prettiest bottle, wipe it down, make sure the label's correct, hold it up to the light, and sing praises to the goddess Pomona, and ship it off to the judges who are retail buyers, and they're the folks that really determine whether the cider is at the price point and going to hit the market at that kind of mass market level, perhaps, or at that high-end restaurant, perhaps. There are all kinds of buyers in this judging competition, which really makes it unique. Again, go to NYICiderCompetition.com. And now it's time for the Q&A with Fermentis. And once again, we're going to be hearing from Kevin Lane and talking about whether or not Fermentis has liquid or dry yeast. And what's the difference anyways?
Hello, my name is Kevin Lane, and I'm the technical sales support manager for the Americas for Fermentis. That's a very interesting question. Fermentis actually creates a lot of liquid yeast in the process of creating dry yeast, but we do not sell liquid yeast at the moment. The reason behind that really isn't for us to have more headache or more complication to the process, but rather that we really want to provide the healthiest, the best yeast that we can to the end users. And the best way for us to do that is for us to have a very shelf-stable product. So the reason that we go through the drying process is to really preserve the health of the yeast coming right from our propagation, which is extremely healthy because we're able to control everything in the process with an entirely dosed propagation system. We control the sugar concentration below 0.5%. Really, there's very little, if any, alcohol produced. And it's fully aerobic with mineral and vitamin dosing as well. So each propagation is really tailored to the yeast strain. And then we take the yeast right from that extremely healthy point during propagation, and we go through the drying process, which is multiple steps. Each reducing the moisture content a little bit every time because you don't want to go right from liquid yeast to cooking the water out. So we do it step by step, carefully removing the water from the yeast and end up in a dry yeast product at the end, which is going to be somewhere between 94 and 96.5% dry matter. In fact, there is such a low amount of residual water left, and it's all bound water molecules, that it's okay to freeze our dry yeast in the package. You can put it into a freezer, let it freeze. Nothing negative is going to happen because there's no free water molecules to crystallize. But when it comes to what's best for cider, I think that decision is up to the end user. Obviously, working for Fermentis, I would say that the dry yeast is better for cider. Simply because it's so much easier to use. There's no need to revitalize it in a propagation or a starter. Really, it's you open the package, you add it to your fermentation, and you let it go, and it will do its thing. It will do the same thing every time. So it's a very consistent process, a very consistent product for people looking to do fermentations. And that's really the reason why we go through the drying process, is to create this stable microorganism that is really easy to use, and you can expect the same results every time you use it and not have any difficulty with really revitalizing or building the yeast health or viability back up. And you should never have concerns about vitality, how the yeast actually performs either.
Thanks, Kevin. That was really informative, the difference between liquid and dry yeast. And I love the idea that Fermentis is drawing out the liquid so that they really are able to deliver to the makers a yeast that has a lot of vitality and shelf stability over the term and transport to your cidery, your basement, your home, wherever you're doing that, and then into the apple juice to ferment. That's pretty cool. Next week, we're going to be talking about whether you should rehydrate your dry yeast in water or perhaps apple juice. So stay tuned for the Q&A with Fermentis next week. So if you want to find out more, you want to get some Fermentis yeast, go to Fermentis, that's spelled ferment and then an IS at the end, .com. It's time now for our feature presentation on blending. Blending is a key part of cider making. It can take place at the pressing of the apple juice prior to ferment or after the cider has finished fermenting. Knowing when to blend is not something you can learn from reading a book because it is not a strict science. To blend requires a fine palate, a developed nose, and a bounty of apple knowledge. Makers are much like chefs in a kitchen. They both may be following a recipe, but the final product is reliant upon their own palate and understanding of the ingredients. Michelin star chefs don't happen overnight, right? Neither do fine cider makers. For this episode in blending, I wanted to hear from Chuck Shelton of Albemarle Cider Works and Vintage Virginia Apples. Chuck credits Tom Burford, who we lost in 2020. He was a champion of heirloom apples and a close friend of Albemarle and the Shelton family. He also credits Ben Watson, author of Cider Hard and Sweet, Histories, Traditions, and Making Your Own, and it's now in its second edition. And Peter J. Hatch, who is an apple author, professional gardener, and historian in the restoration care at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Let's now all grab a glass and join this chat with cider makers Chuck Shelton and David Timmerman at Albemarle Cider Works.
If you don't know anything about cider or what makes cider fruit, it helps to have somebody lead you into it. And I think we had that. Cider is still pretty much a blank palate in the United States. Historical ties to the apples that we started collecting here, Newtown Pippin, or Albemarle Pippin as we call it, Winesap, Virginia Crab, Black Twig, Damon, all these are apples that are grown or have been grown along the eastern Blue Ridge where we live. And to have someone like Tom who'd done a lot of research on this, and not just for cider, but for apples preservation in general. He helped provide some of our early trees, end up with 200 and some varieties, which that didn't have anything to do with cider per se, but it gives you something to work with. From Peter Hatch's work at Monticello, that what Jefferson's cider orchard looked like, or kind of, we've used all of that to guide us into our cider making philosophy, if you will. And then have a book like Ben's available to basically had done all the research around the world on English cider, French cider, and it was all in there if you want to read it. I'm not a great reader, but I did read the parts of that were important. And I decided pretty early on that we're not going to make French cider here. I mean, you might, if you're lucky enough to live in a climate that you can produce those apples well. We're not making British cider necessarily, but we had a history that was essentially buried or lost of American cider that probably rivaled anything that came out of those two countries. It just disappeared. So we're kind of recreating some of that. People ask, what kind of cider do you make? I make an American cider. I'm using cider apples. I call them cider apples because they have 300-year history in a lot of cases. And they have just exceptional taste characteristics. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, how we got to where we are and why we're picking fruit that we are using. One, because we know about it. And two, because it is available. That's the other key. I mean, if you don't have the apple available, nobody's going to make anything from it. So we're pretty fortunate that some of the orchards have come along and at kind of our request, there's been some background work done on it, but there's some cider fruit, what I call cider fruit, historic heirloom cider fruit. It's being produced in our local orchards, and that's what's feeding into Virginia cider right now. And some out-of-state ciders, because if the market is there, they'll be able to market the juice outside the state of Virginia. It's just, it's still in its early days. This is in the last 5 or 6 years that that's happened, but where we got into where we are right now.
I think that's a good overview. I hear a lot about Southern apple varieties, and that's mm-hmm. a big growing interest. And, you know, the folks that you're mentioning, Tom especially, really like contributed quite a bit to that. So was that part of the cidery early on, was looking at very, of course, right, specific to your zone and to your region? That's kind of like a wise approach for anyone to take to begin with.
Yeah, I would say this, though. We weren't looking at Southern as a source of the apple. There are some that are overlooked, and they're not being grown very widely. And I don't know if they've ever been grown that widely. But, yes, there's ample room for expanding our apple repertoire from just varieties that originate in the South. But Newtown Piven is from New York. Harrison is from New Jersey. Winesap may be from New Jersey. It might be from Virginia. It's from somewhere in the mid-Atlantic.
At this point in the conversation, Chuck was noting an author by the name of Downing, and the full name is Andrew J. Downing. He and his brother Charles were both horticulturists, and there is a book out of 1845 called The Fruits and Fruit Trees of America. And in that book, it talks about the best location for growing apples to be between the Mohawk River to the north and the James River to the south.
Well, someone has already proven that we're good back then. So,
right. So that's your basis there, and that historical perspective. I think that's really good info for people kind of starting out and thinking about an orchard. Kind of look what people are already doing and look within your zone, and not try to reinvent the wheel. So you started there, and then moving forward on blending, you know, because you're starting at that apple tree, and then you want to get it into a bottle. So what are the steps that you're taking there? What's the process? Can you kind of run us through that a little bit?
We don't do any real quantitative testing. We don't measure. I mean, we measure with our mouths. We're qualitative testers, if you will. We taste the apple in the orchard. And we know some from history, but some of it we can taste it in the fruit. When you taste it off the tree and you know it's ripe, that's when you want to pick it, or just before it gets ripe so it doesn't rot in storage. But so we know kind of what apples we want, and we kind of know when they're supposed to ripe. Well, that's all over the book now because of global warming and stuff. It's kind of hard to pin it down, but we rely on the orchards that we buy from to pick them when they're ripe, and we're trying to pick them here when they're ripe. And there's all kinds of things that influence that. You know, if you know there's a big windstorm coming, you've got to get them off the tree, or if they're off, they're falling. Some people want them off the ground, but when you get apples off the ground, you got to do something with them right away. And I noticed one of your questions was, do we store apples? Yes, we absolutely do. We have two cold storage now, and we rely on other orchards to pull them in cold storage and we can get them. And then we've got a pretty good cold storage volume here ourselves. So yes, we do essentially sweat the apples, sometimes on purpose, sometimes just till we can get to them. So things that will hold in storage longer and maybe get better, they get pressed later. So we kind of, we're looking at all of that, but again, it's kind of qualitative. And that's the best I can tell someone. Get started, do it, and you'll figure this out on your own, because you'll know when to press an apple, when the sugar's totally there. There are ways of telling it without measuring it, but you can tell by taste. You can cut an apple in half and look at the ring of ripening that's going out, and you pretty much tell where it is. You can do an iodine test. It's kind of messy, and I've never really figured it out that well, but I know you can do it. And that's the way to absolutely look at starts in an apple. But I can pretty much do that by knowing. Once I've held an apple in storage for a month and a half, it's dead right. Then my buddy David comes in with a palette that's better than mine, and So he's had a lot to our operation here just in the 2 years he's been here. And it helps to have someone to bounce things off of sometimes and maybe change your mind a little bit about things that you've been doing and maybe do something a little better. So we're kind of tweaking what we do. For instance, I said all of this about American apples, but we're able to get Davinette here now. We're not growing it, but it's being grown in orchards. So if it's available, it should be used in anybody's cider palate to make cider from, because it has characteristics that a lot of the apples that are available here don't have. It has tannins that are just unbelievable. So we're going to use it as long as we can get our hands on it. We're not break our necks to get it, but we've got enough now. We're going to be doing some interesting stuff with it this year. So thanks to David.
Something to look forward to. I really want to sink into what you said, where you measure with our mouths, which I think is totally right on. And I think it speaks through into your cider too. I mean, it's just the way people cook. It's a chef in the cidery in a way. What are you going for in the mouthfeel? And what are you guys drinking anyways?
So Chuck just poured us a glass. This is our single varietal Wixen.
Oh.
So this is a California apple that we're actually starting to get some significant quantities of. And we made this the first time last year, and we've got another tank fermenting right now. I will actually say that I'm kind of a numbers guy myself, and I actually started out making cider at home. And I did try to measure, you know, a lot of the, what is the acidity, you know, doing a TA titration to see what the acid is in the apple and, you know, tasting it to see, does it taste right? Measuring all the sugar, you know, trying to put some numbers behind the flavor. But I was also, the apples I was picking to ferment at home were the ones that I knew were being made into cider here. So, you know, I learned that from seeing what others were doing and learning which apples made a good cider. I love eating apples in a wide variety of flavor. I love tasting those Davinettes and just having, you know, all that moisture removed from your mouth. And you're like, I can see how this is going to go in the cider and knowing what it's going to add, but also recognizing, man, this needs some acid to go with these tannins and, you know, just seeing the different qualities in those apples and how they're going to translate to the glass. I think I have probably changed a lot to the Czech method of cider making, which is, you know, tasting it and saying, this is probably going to make a pretty good cider and just trusting that it'll work out.
You know? I wasn't totally doing this like in the dark ages. I don't have a lab per se. I had a pH meter and it broke and I quit using it. But because I pretty much through the early years when it was working, and I've sent samples to Virginia Tech. They have an enology lab and I sent it off. So they measured TA, malic acid. I've got data in there from years back and 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then finally I quit sending and paying the money to some, because every year it's right in line. Our pH for, well, not the Davinette probably, but all American, what I call American cider apples, the pH is right in the zone of where you want it for fermentation. So I don't really need to know whether it's 3.4 or 3.7. I just know that it's in a fermentable place where that's a recommended range for juice.
Let's talk about your single varietal ferments. And are you, when you're approaching them, you know, you're talking about the wine sap, are you using a base cider at all with that?
No, it's 100%.
100%.
The only two that aren't 100% are Arkansas Black and Black Twig right now. We have done 100% Black Twig, but that apple hasn't been caught on as far as other orchards growing it yet. We may have enough to do a single variety Black Twig this year. We're sitting on right now, and I will do that. Arkansas Black just didn't have the acidity, or the TA was real low.
So you're doing everything at the press. You've kind of gone out to the orchard, bit into the apples, tasted it. And then during the press, you're throwing in the different varieties and they all ferment in the beginning. You don't blend them in afterwards necessarily for the most part.
say Hughes crab, for example. It's great, a single variety. We use it to blend in another cider. It ripens in August. Has tons of water core that doesn't store well at all. Has to be pressed usually by the end of September, early October at the latest. Or you're going to lose that fruit. You're going to lose the quality, and it splits and dries out, and you get less juice out of it. So you have to do something with that. Usually it gets fermented separately. Okay. We got two tanks. One was going to be a single variety, and the other one's going to be blended. The blend that we use that in primarily is 1817. That's our tribute to William Cox. If you read William Cox's book, mm-hmm. The finest liquor you ever tasted was a blend of the crab apple with Harrison and West New Jersey wine set. I stumbled on that years ago, and that's when I first had the opportunity to make that, I didn't. The proportions are immaterial, in my opinion. They just go well together.
The first year, we pressed all those apples together. I think we pressed them early, and we did the batch. We fermented it all together. Mm-hmm. And then last year, like Chuck was saying, we do the Hughes crab because it has to be pressed early. And then we did the wine sap and the Harrison together because they both are ripe around the same time and both keep very well. And then we could choose how to blend those two different batches together afterwards. We were tasting and trialing, like, how much of this one do we want versus the blend of these two? Although I struggled because the blend of those two, I thought was such a good cider, I almost didn't want to put anything in it. But we joked about calling it 1816 instead of 1817. But we ended up blending them all together, and it really does make a fantastic cider. We don't know what proportions William Cox used when he made that cider. We don't even know whether he pressed those apples together or blended them afterwards either. I don't think he specified. He just said that it was a great blend, and we've made it for a few years now, and it's had different characters in it every year. One year was just this intense pineapple and tropical fruit flavor, and in other years it's been a little lighter, and then I think last year's was more of a guava, character to it. So they do make a good cider. And I think we're still going to be learning every year when we make it, what do we want to put in it and what yeast do we use? I mean, that's a whole other aspect of blending. Sometimes we can do single varietal tanks with two different yeasts and then blend those together afterwards. And you get different characters from that as well.
But part of it's expediency. We do things because it's expedient to do. And I've talked with Jocelyn Gazelka about this, and you may know her. She used to work for Diane Flint. She's a winemaker from down in Patrick County, Virginia. And she says, if I'm going to do something like add tannin or add malic acid, something, which I don't do, but if I did, you should do it pre-fermentation so that it gets blended into the mix better. It's like I've done a malic acid addition after the fact. To me, it tasted chemically. It had a chemical feel to it. And she said, and I believe the way around that is if you're going to do that, and if you know enough that you're going to need it, put it in pre-fermentation and let it blend in, and it'll get assimilated better into the mix. But if I had apples of equal ripeness for Hughes, Harrison, and Winesap, I would blend them all at the press. Anybody wants to try that, the Hughes is not going to store long enough because you're picking the other two apples a month or almost 2 months later. And if you hold your Hughes that long, you're going to be sorry.
So do you do all your pressing in the fall and then that's it? Or like into the winter? I mean, we're in December now. You're not pressing all year round. Is that correct?
I pressed all the way into July. Again, that's because of logistics. You have to have a tank to put it in. Okay. So it's been in cold storage. You will at some point start losing characteristics and quality of fruit if you hold it long enough. But you can store pippin and gold rush up to a year. We've done it. I don't recommend doing that. If you're going to press it for cider, do it when it's dead ripe. And for pippin, that's probably sometime between January and March. Gold rush, you can hold easily in the spring and press it. and the characteristics are still there. So we kind of line them up how we know they're going to store, and that's when we press. And we're not aging them in storage necessarily. We're preserving them till we can get to them. But last year we pressed, the last one was at the end of April, I believe, and that was Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. And then we're getting more efficient, and it helps have someone like David, because I was getting behind, and there's a lot of cleaning that goes on, and bottling that has to happen, and things get in the way of actually producing cider.
Right.
So it helps to have more than one person and a good person. But yeah, that's kind of how we operate here. So if I had enough room in tanks and could press them all by the end of the year, I would have done it.
I haven't been to your site yet. I'm hoping, you know, actually I need to do a road trip down to Virginia for sure. But I will be there. You could guarantee that as soon as we get out of this pandemic here. But I'm seeing, it looks like you have a shed roof behind you and you have those stainless steel tanks. There's a little, you know, walk going up, a little step walk. That is your fermentation room, is that, or is that your total production room?
Yeah, we're sitting in our tank room. Yes.
Your tank room. Okay.
We ferment here, we bottle in here, and we store a bunch of cider. You can't see that, but it's right over there. And I'd like to have it all sold and out of here, but it's just sitting there, and it only moves like molasses, but and it keeps happening, so we keep adding to the stock. But we're trying to temper our enthusiasm, but this is where it happened. This is fermentation. The press room is right on the end of this building. And we have six fermenters, and we have one. Can't see that one either. It's basically a converted bright beer tank. That's our bottling tank.
I see.
So we force carbonate in that, and our bottler is right over to David's right.
Oh, what you got there?
This is basically David's creation. He did the one last year. This is a bottle. This is the same product. That's our bottle of Orchard Bus. We got a different bottle this year, but it's the same kind of basic blend. And we're learning about preserving color. So that is a blend. It's done in the press because we want the red fleshed apple separate. And we're adding a few things into them to give it acid. Well, they all have acid. Those apples are just rich in acid, but they don't detract from the color. And like Doggo adds a little pink to it. So we're trying to get as pink as possible in that cider and preserve it. So
cool.
It's not easy. So
yeah. So to talk about blending of that, that's also another blend. That's somewhat of a blend of necessity in that I literally find every red fleshed apple I can get my hands on to put in there. And they all have good acidity and they all have good cider qualities, but we can't afford to do like, you know, oh, we just want a little bit of this or a little bit of that. We're putting every red fleshed apple we can get in there. And eventually we might have that, be able to make that choice to say, you know, I want a little less Dolgo crab in this, or I want, you know, a little more Geneva crab in it to get the color a little richer. But right now, let's put everything we can in there. Last year was the first year we did it. It was completely an experiment. And we liked the result we got out of it. So we made it again this year.
I've been to like Steve Wood up at Farnham Hill, and he's brought out, you know, honestly, got like beakers for his blending. So I'm sensing no beaker stuff. I see. Yeah. Chuck
but I understand why they did it. Well, one, he had Nicole working with him. She's like David. She has a palate that's second to none, I think. And I don't have that. They told me they shut their coal room down and they put their cider tanks in there just to keep them from freezing.
Right.
And you know, they're in a completely different situation. But
yeah.
If you're going to mix those and you want to test them, yeah, you got to do that. And if they soar the same and they ripen in the same time, then you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with that. He makes great cider, so I'm not going to argue with him.
No, absolutely. Like, absolutely. I was wondering, you know, with David, you kind of coming from like a home cider maker into a commercial operation, what's like been the mm-hmm. biggest change for you in terms of blending and what you've learned from working with Chuck?
I actually wasn't doing that much blending at home either. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of following Chuck's lead. I mean, I started making cider after I started drinking cider from here. Mm. And so I started making cider using a lot of the same apples because they're widely available in our state. And, you know, I tried to do some of that careful blending of, you know, I put lined up a bunch of little bottles and I put cider in there and we were doing, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And I didn't often love the mix that I was making better than I loved the individuals. And maybe that's because we love those individual variety apples so much that we then hate watering them down with the characteristics of another apple. So I don't know that I've changed all that much. I think, you know, loving the cider that Chuck was making here led me to want to work here. And so, and I love the single varietals that we produce here.
Let me make no mistake, David made cider at home, but he is not a typical home cider maker. David was just shy of being a commercial cider maker in terms of what he put together and his equipment. And he went after the good apples, so and they were available to him. But now he's not turning out a weekend project in the garage. He had a chiller and some tanks with carbonating capabilities, and I know there's all different levels of home cider. But yes.
Well, do you guys look for something in particular for each of your ciders? Like if Claude Jacques was, you know, talking about blending, he'd be looking for like sugar, acidity, tannin, and then he looks at like nutrient level for like a slow ferment. Does any of that like factor into your tasting? Are you, you know, because we don't have high tannic apples necessarily, but you're using Dabinet now, so that's different.
I'm looking for the acid. We just had one, a great one from Eden. If you haven't tried Belle de Bust, you.
Oh, I haven't had it, but she has great ciders up there. That's fantastic ciders. Yeah.
If you use a great apple, you're going to get, that's what it takes to make a good cider is a great apple.
Yeah.
It's been said by a lot of other people besides me, but it's just the truth. The truth.
When Chuck speaks, I listen. I just adore this guy. You know, he was one of these people straight out of the box when I was rolling out Cider Chat, who donated some money to the podcast just out of the blue. I'd never met him or anything. And then I had the opportunity to meet him at CiderCon in Chicago. I guess that was in 2017. Pretty unpretentious guy, if you can't tell. And all the while during this conversation, you could hear in the background that, like, you know, dropping in the background, the boom, 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 and rumbling. That was he and David sitting in the cider house trying cider, sipping. I mean, the whole family down there, that is really something. And we are all the luckier for it. I love how he kind of creates that category, American cider. He just owns it and not doing it in a like an egotistical way. He just owns it because it's 100% authentic and real. If you have not had any of their ciders, highly recommend it. In fact, I toasted New Year's Day with a bottle of Gold Rush. A couple days after this recording that I did with them, all of a sudden this box arrived at my doorstep filled with 6 bottles of Albemarle Cider Works. And talk about hitting the lottery, cheese and crow. There was other swag in there, a nice bottle opener and some decals. I was floored. And then a thank you note. So, beautiful people, check out their cider and take these tips to heart around blending. I mean, David
is an outstanding guy too. He traveled with me to Normandy, France on a Totally Cider Tours that I led back in 2018. I've gotten to know him over the years. He, like Chuck, also became a patron of Cider Chat way before, you know, he was doing anything commercially. Just outstanding people. So we are all the luckier for that. And, you know, I know they're not alone because you are one of those outstanding people too. And we're all flying into 2021, holding each other in our arms and just looking forward to success. Because when you're thinking about success, there's no time to consider failure. And with that, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Cider, we like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there
is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes,
there is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
It's just the truth.
Yeehaw!